Well, I would like to introduce our keynote presentation this morning, Dr. Frank Tolewski, and he is the curator of the William James Beale Garden that if you look out the windows, you get a small sampling. And you are going to speak about the history of Beale and the development of campus. All right, please.
Okay, thank you. Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to address all of you here. I'm going to put on my mic here in a moment.
Is it on now? Yeah. Yeah, excellent. Hey, good deal. Yay.
You don't have to stand here.
Right, no, I kind of feel a little claustrophobic back here. I usually like to talk in front of my audience. But the Beale Botanical Garden, as you are probably aware by now, and if not, you'll notice it from the slide, was founded in 1873 by Professor William James Beale. And back then, Professor Beale just kind of referred to it as the Botanic Garden, and a lot of people here at Michigan State Agricultural College, as we were known back then, referred to it as the Wild Garden. And so if you want to go collecting postcards, if you do that sort of thing, if you see a card from the East Lansing area, it says the Wild Garden or the Sunken Garden, that is the W.J. Beale Botanical Garden. It wasn't named the W.J. Beale Botanical Garden, as we'll see momentarily, until 1924 when Professor Beale passed away and by state. I guess that helps too. And then this needs to be turned on if I remember correctly. It's on. All right. Anyway, by state decree, the garden was named officially for Professor Beale. So it is our 140th anniversary. So look at that. You came for our 140th anniversary. Thank you very much. How many of you are affiliated with the Botanical Garden? Okay. Ah, excellent. How many of you are members of APGA? And will you be going to Phoenix? Any of you going to Phoenix in a couple of weeks? No. Unfortunately, I won't either. I've got jury duty. So it's kind of a bummer because the Desert Botanic Garden is absolutely fantastic. The Sonoran Desert Museum is a wonderful, incredible place, as is the Boyce Thompson. I used to work at the University of Arizona down in Tucson, so I know all the institutions quite well and personally. But anyway, let's continue on about the W.J. Beale Botanical Garden. So in the beginning, the garden at Michigan State Agricultural College was founded in 1873, as I said before, by Professor Beale. And the main reason why he founded it was because back then, agriculture was taking over Michigan, drain fields were putting in, drain commissions were draining swamps and turning them into farm fields and pasture for agriculture. And more of the native natural green space, the diversity of plants that surrounded the college campus began to disappear. Plus, there were other things that he wanted to bring in that were unusual for teaching and research purposes that didn't grow in the Michigan area. And so he created the Botanical Garden as a living laboratory. And Professor Beale got his training at Harvard University, one of the places he got, the University of Michigan, and then on to Harvard University, where he worked under Professor Asa Gray. And Professor Gray, I'm sure, as you know, looking at his writings, his biography, autobiography, had a major influence on his view of science and botany, as you would expect. And Harvard had a botanical garden on campus. And now there's a dormitory complex called the Botanic Garden. So unfortunately, Harvard needed space. They were in a tight environment. They developed the Arnold Arboretum. Anybody here from the Arnold? All right. So we have a linkage. So the Arnold Arboretum was actually founded a year before we were, 1872. So their university garden, they're off campus or not on campus. They were founded a year before we were, but they're an arboretum, not a botanical garden. So when I came here, we had this whole thing about, you know, oh, we're the oldest continuously operated botanical garden in the world. I said, well, no, you're not. I hate to break the news to you on my new job here, but you're not. If you look at Missouri Botanical Garden, anybody from Missouri? Okay, Missouri Botanic Garden was founded in 1850. I can't remember the exact date, and they've been continuously operated. There have been other gardens that have been founded much earlier than Beale or Arnold or Missouri, but they have not been continuous operating. I mean, Bertram's Garden in Philadelphia, certainly founded decades earlier, if not a century earlier, but was not in continuous operation, had to go through a restoration. Anybody here in Bertram? No, okay. So wonderful institutions around the country, and I'm proud that we're up there amongst the, you know, the top of the heap there of gardens that have been founded. So Professor Beal, I'm sure you know, received his inspiration from Harvard and from the botanical garden that was once on campus. As a matter of fact, if we go outside to Beaumont Tower and you look on the west side of Beaumont Tower, which used to be our original building called College Hall, you'll see a ginkgo tree, Ginkgo biloba. And that was actually a gift of Professor Gray to Michigan State Agricultural College in 1863. And it was given to Professor Thurber, who was the previous botany professor here at Michigan State before Professor Beal came in 1870. So kind of one of those, you know, how many degrees of separation do you have from, you know, Professor Gray, Professor Beal, Harvard, Michigan State? There's some really good linkages there with the old institutions. We see many plants from the Arnold subsequently that we have on campus today, including, and you'll see it this tomorrow afternoon down in the Beal Botanical Garden, one of the original metasequoias from the Arnold. So doing quite well. Anyway, so by 1877, the garden was widely recognized and was unofficially, as I've heard to before, called the Wild Garden. See, I can just go on and on with this stuff. But anyway, Professor Beal was born March 11th, 1833 in Adrian, Michigan. So he's a native Michigander. He died in 1924. So I'm hoping that I'm, you know, as fortunate as Professor Beal was, a good long life. He attended University of Michigan, 1855 to 1859. Michigan State was founded in 1855. He taught at the Friends Academy in Union Springs, New York for a period of time before attending, and then attended Harvard University 1861 to 1863, and he said before studying with Professor Gray and Agassiz and Wyman. So really a significant influence on his life and the future of science. This was a very important time in science, as you all know, because of the work of Charles Darwin, Origin of a Species, hybrid vigor, and so forth. A lot of the work, Power of Movement in Plants, some fantastic books that were published at that time. I don't have any first editions, but at least I've got some second editions. So, yes, I do collect books. It's a terrible addiction, isn't it? So, hi, I am a book collector. Anyway, continue on. He taught at Chicago University. For a period of time. He first lectured on July 9th of 1870 here at Michigan State and was professor of botany and horticulture at MAC from 1871 to 1881. Again, his biography here, professor of botany and forestry, 1881 to 1902. So really, when he came in, he was professor of botany and horticulture, then the horticulture department spun off on its own. Most of you recognize the name Liberty Hyde Bailey. Liberty Hyde Bailey was a student of Professor Beal's here at Michigan State. Liberty Hyde Bailey actually for a while was the chair of the horticulture department and was responsible for the design and building of Eustace Hall, which is the first building on campus that was built specifically for the purpose of teaching horticulture and horticultural sciences. So that's just up here around the bend behind Linton Hall in what we call Historic Row. So if you get a chance to walk around campus, you check out the plaque on the front that recognizes the contribution of Professor Bailey. And in the Horticultural Demonstration Gardens down on South Campus, there's a statue of Professor Bailey as well, recognizing his contribution. So anyway, horticulture was spun off as its own department, and then he became botany and forestry. And Professor Beal, if I have time here at the end, I maybe talk a little bit about his forestry contribution here on campus and across the state of Michigan. But again, the forestry department spun off as its own department in 1902 under the auspices of Professor Bogue. Bogue Street, of course, on campus here, named in recognition of Professor Bogue. Received a doctorate degree from Michigan Agricultural College in 1905. He's becoming a fairly old man at this point in time. He retired 5 years later in 1910 and retired from MAC and moved to Amherst, Massachusetts, where his daughter lived. So anybody here from UMass? Okay, UMass has a wonderful history as well, and we'll talk a little bit about that as, you know, one degree of separation there as well. So this is the old botany lab as it once existed, and it existed right out the window over here on the other side of the garden. There's a historical marker there. Unfortunately, back in these days, how did you heat buildings? Wood-burning stoves. How did you keep wood-burning stoves going? Well, you had students who were allowed to live up in the dormer parts of the building to keep the building going. And one night, one of those stoves, unfortunately, caught the building on fire. And like so many buildings here on campus, it burned down. Olds Hall, right next to us, where I am, burned down. Saints Rest, just on the other side of the MSU Museum. You'll see a historical marker there. There's foundations underground, and that's about it. It burned down because of wood-burning stoves. So when you were a student back then, not only did you have to fight off malaria, but you had to go out and split your own wood to keep the fires burning, to keep yourself warm and dry your clothes. So, but this is what the garden looked like back in the 1870s. That's a young Professor Beale. It's probably one of the youngest photographs we have of Professor Beale. And that's Wells Hall in the background over here. And this is the botanical garden, will become the botanical garden. Most of the garden is to the south of this little wood bridge right here. And as you'll see in the next photograph a few years later, Professor Beale has expanded the garden all the way up into this area. And this is what's right outside the window right now, if we look down into the garden. And that right there is the old chemistry laboratories where the fountains in front of this building are today. And if we look at the campus, so here's a nice insurance map, Sanborn map of campus that I kind of modified. We can see Olds, the R.A. Olds Hall Engineering Hall. That's where I am. My office is right on the fourth floor, right about, if I can stop shaking, there. And Wells Hall was right over here. And then the botany greenhouse and headhouse were located right up here. And of course, today, this is all the library. Here's the chemical laboratory. Here's the museum. That still exists. This is gone. Beaumont Tower is up here now. And this is Linton Hall. And Linton Hall exists. So this building exists and that one exists. The gymnasium exists. It's been expanded much larger than it is now. And Olds Hall exists. There used to be a power plant here, railroad tracks. Coal. That's all gone. That's now the Hanna Administration Building out there. But if we advance this a little bit, whoop, ta-da, there's the Beale Botanical Garden. That's where we fit in the grand scheme of things. And the garden started out, actually the garden didn't start out as officially as the Botanical Garden. It started out up here next to the music building. And this is a little piece of land called Sleepy Hollow. And what Professor Beale did in Sleepy Hollow is he started experimenting in 1873 with plots of grass and other plants and conducting experiments. So you can actually see the kind of the linear layout of the beds up here. And so really from the turf grass perspective, we are the oldest turf grass institution. Where's our turf grass librarian? Right? So, I mean, we are the oldest turf grass institution in the country as well. So there was a nice paper published by the folks at turf grass recently on Beale's history and contribution to working on turf grass. The garden itself was established then down in this little portion here and then spread up, as you can see in those two earlier photographs, into this portion of the garden. So Beale would have been sitting right about there in that earliest photograph and the garden here. You can see this little stream. It was actually a little stream that flowed through Sleepy Hollow underneath the Stone Arch Bridge, which is now all filled in. We're looking forward to doing a lot of work out here. They're going to do an excavation. We may find the remains of that bridge when they excavate to do some steam tunnel replacements. But that stream flowed all the way up into East Lansing. And back then, the four-cylinder vehicles ate hay. And they also left that hay on the street. It didn't go into the atmosphere's carbon dioxide as much. There was some solid waste, and that would wash down off the streets of East Lansing and flow through the garden and into the Red Cedar River. So there was pollution. Who'd have thought it? Pollution back in the 1880s, 1890s, 1910. And so as part of that, and before Beale retired, they actually ended up putting this stream into a storm sewer, which now flows through underneath, underground the garden, and filled the garden in anywhere between 2 and 10 feet worth of soil and raised the level. The good thing about the garden, and Professor Beale, again, maybe thinking from the Harvard experience, not realizing that the garden was going to disappear short order to Harvard, but Professor Beale put the garden down in here because he realized that this is part of the floodway of the Red Cedar River. We had flooding actually in the Red Cedar River this spring, and the floodwaters actually came right up to about here. We've actually had floodwaters come up to the first step of the staircase up here in the garden. So he realized that, nobody's gonna build a building here. It's a floodplain. So that's probably why we still have a botanical garden here at Michigan State. Although the university takes a lot of pride in the garden and preserving it. So I think that, you know, even if it wasn't there, there was pressure on it. Fortunately, we do have a fair amount of land compared to more urban environments like Harvard, like University of Michigan, like University of Chicago. That we can actually spread ourselves out a little bit more and conserve some of our green space. So, anyway, here's the blow up of the garden. You can see this is that little set of plots, a weed garden and a grass garden up here. This is a map from 1895 that Professor Beale published. And then this is the actual garden down below. And you see that it had a much more meandering kind of bed design than the formal bed design that we have today. And the garden shed and the pond are located right over here, and we'll see more of that as we progress through the talk. So again, kind of how the garden continued to grow and change over the decades. So here's a shot, and again, here's that wood bridge we saw in the earlier photographs. Professor Beal would have been off to our left up on the embankment, and here's that little stream flowing through it. And then we have these little tiny stairs, which have now been replaced with much larger stairs coming off of West Circle Drive. So we're basically looking north. Beaumont Tower would be behind this tree over here. And then we can see these wonderful photographs from MSU Archives and Historical Collections. Just some of the gardens. Plants are labeled. It's a botanical garden. He had records for the plants. We've been actually able to find some of those records and began to incorporate those into our digital record keeping. Here's one of the ponds. Again, this was a floodway. There were these little oxbow ponds left in the meander of the Red Cedar River, where the Red Cedar River had cut through. And these were natural at that point in time. Little dirt paths lined with stones. There's another one of the ponds, view of the ponds. Here's a shot of the garden. This is actually a postcard. Again, we can see Wells Hall. Library's here today. The old chemistry laboratories, the fountains are here today. Down here, the gardens, which are still here today. Yay! And here's another postcard, kind of colorized postcard. I always kind of thought this was fun. This is from 1906, November 10th, as we can see the date. It says, again, the Wild Garden, Agricultural College, Lansing, Michigan. But, you know, everybody talks about texting and, people have shorthand in texting. What's the date here? You know, this is over 100 years old. Just a line to let you know that I, see the little I there, still live on the old farm. Sending your long day. Anyway.
Long day.
Yeah, so anyway, but this person was actually studying about Egyptology and Egypt. So, of course, you see that little I up there. It looks very much like, the hieroglyphics I. Like kind of fun stuff. So this is tweeting, in the early 20th century. This is texting in the early 20th century. So we kind of criticize our kids because they're doing LOL or something like that. So but they were doing nothing changes. So anyway, here's a picture again of the garden. This shows the garden shed. These trees right here, actually, if we look at this spruce tree and we look at these cedar trees, these still exist. These spruce trees were actually part of a collection of 350 spruce trees that were planted on campus in 1865, along with 150 white cedar trees. Here's Professor Beal. So we're obviously getting into the late 19th century, early 20th century, circa 1900s. But again, this pond is where the concrete pond is today. So there's a concrete pond, and there's a garden shed that sits right behind here in this area here, and this tree right here is right directly behind it. And here again, you can see that tree. That's that tree again. Here is the botany laboratory head house for the greenhouse. The greenhouse is behind this structure right up here. This is now all MSU Library, where we're standing right now. A little bit, probably standing up about there. Again, see the garden, collection of plants, extensive collection of plants. And here's somebody that wants to shimmied up a flagpole or maybe one of the old spruce trees. Actually, those spruce trees, if you look out the window right here, these two spruce trees, Norway spruces right out here, are also from that 1865 planting. And so they got the picture. You can see part of the greenhouse here. If you go to the herbarium, they actually have the original blueprints for that greenhouse, still at the MSU, Beal Darlington Herbarium. And you can see a lot of the test beds here, cold frames and so forth. So this was all now MSU Library. Well, a couple of things that Professor Beal was very well known for. One was, of course, his long-range study on seed viability. So in 1879, Professor Beal was trying to attempt to answer a question that many farmers had been asking, and that was, in the day before Roundup and 2,4-D and other herbicides, how long is it going to take before I get rid of these pesky weeds in my field if I go out there and cultivate? So Professor Beal buried 20 bottles of seeds. Each containing 20 species of seeds. I think it's actually 23 species. I need to change that. And every 5 years, with the intent that every 5 years, he would dig up a bottle, shake out this mix of seed and sand, and see what would germinate. I was a graduate student in 1980, studying plant physiology, and heard about the 100th anniversary of the bottles. If I ever thought that I would be the person who would dig up the next bottle 20 years later, no, good luck. I had no clue. So I'm quite honored that in the year 2000, I got to excavate the 120th year bottle and see what would germinate. And that's a much younger version of me right there. And here we see the verbascums. We had almost a 50% germination rate for verbascum blatteria, and that's why we've decided to adopt it. Even though it's a non-native and weedy species, we've adopted it as our logo because it represents the long-range vision and longevity of Professor Beal's contribution to science. So again, a very interesting thing. The study started out, the one weakness of the study, unfortunately, if I had a time machine, I could go back and talk to Professor Beal. Could you do me a favor? Just do a germination before you started the experiment so we know what the baseline germination of the seeds were. He didn't do that, so really the first baseline germination is the five-year period that he opened up the first bottle. This was continued on. He passed the experiment. He clearly had a vision that this was going to be going on beyond him in terms of research. And he passed the experiment on to Professor Darlington, and Professor Darlington conducted the research every 5 years until about 1940, I think was the date, that he changed it to every 10 years. He says, hey, we're getting the same things that are still germinating. Let's spread this out. And so every 10 years, a bottle was excavated up to 1980. And then in 1980, the plant biology, the botany and plant pathology department, as it was called at the time, made a decision that why don't we extend this to every 20 years? And so then 2000 was the 20th year, 120th year, when I opened up, excavated the bottle. But the reason why I talk about it would have been nice to have a baseline germination is because two things germinated in the year 2000. We had lots and lots of this moth mullein. But we also had a Malva, Malva rotundifolia, or Malva neglected, depending on whose taxonomy you go with. And this is a little scrambling little weed. It's in the hibiscus family. So it has that very nice hibiscus flower, but the flower's only about that big. If it was more showy and larger, it would be a horticultural success. But one of those germinated, only one of those germinated in 2000. And if I look back at the records, because I went back and I started, as a good researcher, reading all the primary literature, all the papers that were published on this experiment before we published our paper, and found out that it was sporadically showed up in various experiments, but it wasn't as consistent as verbascum. Verbascum shows up every single time, and it shows up gangbusters with lots of good germination. So when I got back to Professor Beal's first paper, Professor Beal always insisted on being a keen observer of the world around you. That's what he tried to instill in his students. He had a great saying, keep squinting, okay? He would give a student a piece of a plant and say, okay, go back, look at it, and come back and tell me what you see. And a student, it was a flower, okay, I see stigma style, stamens, petals. What else did you see? Go back, okay? I see sepals, I see the ovaries, cut it open. Can I go now? It's a beautiful summer, spring day. No, go back, keep squinting. Tell me what you've seen. Become a keen observer. It's sort of like those old puzzles in the newspapers, where you have the two, tell me what's the difference between the two pictures. I love those. I love doing that. And that's a great way to train students as well, to become a keen observer. But anyway, what he reported, because he was a keen observer, in his first publication was that he had noticed that there were many Malva seeds, that he'd see the seed coats, but when he broke the seeds open, they were hollow. And so the seeds going into the experiment must have had a low set rate, that they were not fertile to begin with going into the experiment. So there would have been probably a low germination rate. So who knows, Malva rotundifolia, if we had had a high germination percentage, a high seed set to begin with, may be at the same germination rate that we see Malva, a 50% germination rate. We just don't know what the rate was going into the experiment to start with. Another thing that Professor Beal was involved with, and a major game changer for agriculture in the country and around the world, is hybrid corn. Professor Beal, again, was a contemporary of Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin had just published a book on hybrid vigor in plants and animals, and being a good scientist, a good professor, researcher, Professor Beal had just read that book and became very inspired and wrote to Charles Darwin about, what do you think about working with hybridizing corn to increase yield in this important grass crop? And so Charles Darwin actually wrote back to Professor Beal, as we see in this letter from May 21st of 1878, encouraged encouraging Professor Beal to conduct the study. And Professor Beal did go on to conduct the study down in the Beal Botanical Garden. There's a historic marker down by the pond. We need to get it straightened out. It's kind of sinking a little bit from the last flood, I think, softened the soil underneath it. But again, Professor Beal is recognized as the father of modern hybrid corn. So he actually was able to make crosses in the garden and significantly increase the yield of corn. So a very important discovery. And you know, if you go on the web and you Google this, you can even find this is from the Children's Museum down at Indianapolis. Recognition, William James Beal is credited with crossbreeding corn to make the first hybrid corn. Now, some people say, well, didn't Native Americans hybridize corn? Well, of course, because corn is a hybrid, the teosinte and gamma grass and some connections. So he's the modern hybridizer. I mean, originally, corn from the get-go was a hybrid. So some people would argue that. So I think that if you think about modern hybrid corn, we could put that little bit of a caveat in there. So Johannes Wilbrink, Johannes Uphoff, became curator of the garden for an intermediate time. Professor Beal retired in 1910. Professor Darlington did not come until 1915. And so the garden went through a short period where Johannes, who had worked with Professor Beal in the garden, was the curator of the garden. And then Professor Darlington arrived in 1914, 1915 as a professor in the botany department. And a wonderful thing happened a few years ago. I've got a phone call from a person out in the Los Angeles area who happened to be Professor Darlington's son. And he was going through his attic, you know, kind of sorting through his personal belongings. And he found the original letter from Professor Beal to his father, passing the reins of the curatorial duties of the garden on. And so I dutifully made a copy and transcribed the letter and then gave the copy over to our MSU Archives and Historical Collections for proper conservation, since they have the capacity to do that, and that's really where that belongs. But it would be wonderful to have that addition to the collection, to actually see Professor Beal's words to Professor Darlington. Then on December 17th, 1924, the State Board of Agriculture approved the recommendation of the Botany Department to name the botanical gardens for Professor Beal. And so we officially became the W.J. Beal Botanical Garden on this date. H.L.R. Chapman was hired by Professor Darlington in 1925. He was a trainee from the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew and was head gardener and superintendent, and he would serve until 1949. Professor Darlington loved the garden and really had visions of expanding the garden. And so if we look at the original design of the garden once again, we can see that this is the present garden. And here's the old chemistry laboratories we talked about. Here's the greenhouses in Wells Hall. This is now the MSU library. Gymnasium over here, which would expand in the future. But he had this whole expansion for the garden down in here. And actually, one of the little things is that if you zoom in right there, I should probably really make a little zoom in for you guys, but you know, I remember showing this to Jane Taylor. How many of you know Jane Taylor? Yeah, Jane Taylor founded the MSU 4-H Children's Garden. And so when we think of modern children's gardens and gardens around the country today, really that she was on the forefront of that whole getting children involved in gardening and in plants. And that seminal garden now is actually down over by the Horticultural Demonstration Gardens. Hopefully later in the week you have a chance to go see the Horticultural Demonstration Gardens and see the 4-H Children's Garden as well. Norm Lowndes is now the curator, Dr. Lowndes from the Horticulture Department. But when I showed this to Jane, she got so tickled because here it is in 1928. There's a proposal for a children's garden on the MSU campus. So the idea was clearly a MSU concept, and it's really wonderful to see that. But this got Professor Darlington into a lot of trouble because the superintendent and the grounds department was not thrilled with the idea because they saw it as increasing the amount of labor necessary to maintain the facilities. 1928 was not a particularly good time for the U.S. economy. You may remember that from your grandparents or my parents or your parents talking about that, the Great Depression, Black Friday in October of 1928. And so basically he kind of ran into a little bit of problem. And he went to, actually at this time, Liberty Hyde Bailey was up at Cornell. And he had contacted Liberty Hyde Bailey and said, you know, would you support me in going to the Board of Trustees and, you know, and supporting this expansion is my vision for the garden. And Liberty Hyde Bailey actually wrote back and said, you know, I don't think you want to go there. It's not going to be a battle you're going to win. And unfortunately, Professor Darling didn't heed Professor Bailey's words. And he went through to the university and to the board, and the board was very upset and actually ended up removing him as curator, director of the garden. And so this kind of led the garden into a little bit of our dark ages, if you will. Chapman had taken over as curator, and the grounds department was really, you know, seeing a lot of the maintenance of the garden. I think the botany department probably was pretty upset with this, and so there a lot things happened, and the garden basically slumped in terms of its care and its focus. The garden would be delivering flowers to the president's office or the provost's office and doing more horticultural things and less things that we would think of in terms of a botanic garden. And we have a horticulture garden on campus, so why do we need two horticulture gardens on campus? We should, you know, shouldn't have this competition. So President John Hanna, who saw the transfer of Michigan State College to Michigan State University, became very concerned about the decline of the role and mission of the garden. And he said, we need to return to Professor Beal's original vision and original mission for the garden. And so he transferred the garden to a newly developed office called Campus Park and Planning under the direction of Harold Lautner, and asked for the redesign of the garden, working with Milt Barron and George Parmalee, who would be hired by Harold Lautner to come to Michigan State and work it. Milt Barron, who, by the way, celebrates his 100th birthday coming up this month, is still with us and still very clear-headed and has a wonderful memory, is also a Harvard graduate. So he also eventually became the director of Campus Park and Planning when Harold Lautner stepped down. So again, a very wonderful legacy that we have here in contribution. And so President Hanna said, we need to return the garden to its glory. We need to return it to its mission of supporting teaching, outreach, and research, and not just to be a display garden. It needs to be what Beal intended it to be, a living laboratory. Working with the botany department, Professor Gilley became the assistant professor of botany and served as curator of the botanical gardens in 1950. The department chair, Professor Drew, also was involved in the garden. And a wonderful little story about Professor Drew here for a second. Professor Drew is from a long family of botany, starting out at MAC, Massachusetts Agricultural College. All right, which is now UMass Amherst. And Professor Drew's grandfather had been a graduate student at UMass studying under Professor Clark, President Clark. So Professor Clark was president of Massachusetts Agricultural College, and Professor Clark had been hired by the Emperor of Japan in the 1870s to create and establish a Western-style agricultural college in Sapporo on the North Island of Hokkaido. And so he had traveled over there, obviously by boat, and began developing this Western-style, designing this Western-style university, including a agricultural facility, a dairy barn, and so forth. When I came to Michigan State, Jane Taylor had told me a story about the Katsura tree down in Beal Garden, which is a rather large tree, that a professor from MAC had been sent to Japan to set up a dairy. And that professor had sent, you know, the seeds or the plants for the Katsura tree back to Professor Beal. Well, I was thinking MAC, Michigan Agricultural College. Well, Professor Drew's daughter, Cynthia Drew Redmond, came to us a few years ago and said, I want to put a memorial bench in the Beal Botanical Garden in honor of my father, and I'd like it to have a view where we can sit and look at the Katsura tree. Why the Katsura tree? Well, there's a very long family history because my great-grandfather had been in Japan establishing a Western-style agricultural college. Oh, really? With a dairy? Yes, he built a famous dairy barn. Oh, really? Katsura dairy barn? Urban legends, you know, voice stories are very important, but when you get documentation, it's even better. We all know that as librarians and researchers. And so I actually, working with Cynthia and going through the archives at UMass, found out that that tree is one of the original trees that was sent to UMass by, I'm not sure it was Professor Clark or if it was her grandfather, but it was affiliated with that whole expedition to establish this college in Japan for the emperor. So now I've actually got provenance on that tree that I had no idea I had provenance on before. So it's absolutely a wonderful story. And again, making that connection. Again, how many degrees of separation? The botany world, the horticultural world, is not very large. We're not that far removed from a lot of fantastic names in the field. And you know, again, these are great stories. I love telling these stories. But Professor Milt Barron, as I mentioned, celebrates his 100th birthday coming up here. Was a professor in landscape architecture. He was also the curator of the garden for a brief period of time in the early 1950s. And he was responsible for taking President Hanna's vision and making it a reality and redesigning the garden, creating four major collections. The systematic collection, the economic collection, the ecological collection, and a landscape collection of plants. And so when we look at it, this is actually one of Professor Barron's original hand drawings of a vision. You know, he didn't have AutoCAD back then. Okay, it was all done by hand. And you can see his handwriting on there. But again, his concept for laying the garden out, so we have a systematic collection, we have an economic collection, we have our ecological collections on the side here, and we have our horticultural collections that would be on the outskirts of the garden. We would have a new pond put in, a pool, which would be concrete, and the old log cabin garden shed still existed, and later on a new garden shed would be built right up over here. And so here we see a picture of a color photograph of the garden from the garden, probably late 1940s, 1950s. Again, colorized, we see the old log cabin still exists. It still has the dirt pond, so this dates it pre-1960 very clearly. But again, sunken garden, Michigan State College, East Lansing, not the Beale Botanical Garden. It was the Beale Botanical Garden by this point in time, but you know, people still like to give it its own name. George Parmalee was then hired as curator to replace Milt Barron as Milt Barron moved to be director of campus park and planning in 1955 and served until 1986. And he introduced a new system of informative interpretive labels for both garden plants and campus trees. And we'll talk a little bit about that. Here they are. You see these little labels on little 2x2 wooden posts in the garden. These are engraved labels in all these little garden beds. Well, in 1975, when we had the great flood, this was before I was here, I was still in undergraduate school, the story was told to me that the floodwaters were up about this level, and all these little wood stakes started popping out of the ground. Boop, 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 and floating down the Red Cedar River. And so my staff, who were still here when I came in 1993, told me about going out in a rowboat, you know, with a big net, you know, across the Red Cedar River, trolling for plant labels. So we have since changed that. We now have a very interesting stainless steel powder-coated stake that we use. We still use the engraved labels, and you'll see those down in the garden, but a very important feature of the garden. But here's a more modern view of the garden now. As we see, now we have the library up here, where it used to be the greenhouse and Wells Hall, and the chemistry laboratory was up over here. Here's Sleepy Hollow. And here are the display beds. This is the systematic collection. Here is the economic collection. This is the landscape collection all around over in here, and these are ecological association collections on the slopes over here. So in 1973, we celebrated the centennial, the 100th anniversary of the founding of the garden. It was a big celebration. A lot of people came, including some of Beale's living descendants. Professor Beale only had a daughter, so there's no Beale name family lineage. Just the daughter's family lineage, unfortunately, you know, they changed the name for women when they get married, so the Beale name didn't carry on. But there are Beale descendants from his brothers, uncles, second cousins, and so forth that are still around. But anyway, the state recognized the 100th anniversary and commemorated the particular day as Professor William James Beale Week. So that was on May 19th. So the date's coming up. We're now said we're 140 years old this year. So Professor Donnelly, anybody here from the Morton Arboretum? Okay, Professor Donnelly, if you may not know this or you may know it, actually got his PhD here at Michigan State under Dr. Peter Murphy, our ecologist here in plant in botany and plant pathology at the time. And Dr. Donnelly was hired to be the curator of the Beale Botanical Garden here at Michigan State. And so he served from 1986 to 1990. He was responsible for creating the endangered and threatened species collection in the Beale Botanical Garden. And he was also responsible for the very first mapping of our campus trees on campus. Professor Donnelly was hired as executive director of the Morton Arboretum in 1990. And so again, there was a short vacuum of a period of time when the university tried to figure out what are we going to do with the botanical gardens, how are we going to operate it. And so the curators was the position was kind of redefined in 1990. One of the issues that Professor Donnelly had faced was that he was 100% administration Beale Botanical Garden, but he had his tenure home in the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology. And so the Botany and Plant Pathology wanted to have, you know, a certain percentage of his time, but there was no accounting for it. And so when they reorganized the position before I came here, they actually split the position to be 65% administration, 35% academic home. So that's my current appointment. And so I actually have a commitment of time to the academic sector with the expectation to teach, do research, and have graduate students and undergraduate students, which I enjoy. That's the reason why I came here from Buffalo. I mean, the opportunity to be able to teach and be involved in research again, as well as to operate a garden, was an offer I just couldn't refuse. So, and as part of that, they realized that the important situation is providing assistance, so they created a collections manager's position for the garden as well, so that, you know, some of that curatorial duty that the curator had could be alleviated to free up time to do more scholarly activities in the department. So, here I am, 1993 to present. I established the non-flowering vasture plant collection and an endowed trust for the garden. We now have several $1 million of promised gifts, as well as about $2 million active endowment right now that's earning interest for the botanical garden. We have so many wonderful people who treasure the garden and value the garden. People have gotten married down in the garden, got engaged, had their first date, and so forth. One of our donors has a wonderful story. She unfortunately was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago and has passed away. But when she was alive and thinking about the garden and wanting to make a lasting gift, came down and told us that in her freshman year, and she'd come to Michigan State, and it was the first time away from family. And those of you here in the Midwest know how long Michigan winters or Wisconsin winters or so forth can be. And so she, you know, was having a hard time being away from family and all the rigors of college and all these classwork. And she told me a story, and it still makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck. It's a wonderful story about, you know, she walked down into the Beale Garden on a late winter, early spring day. And she says, you know, it's like almost magically, like the clouds kind of parted and the sun began to kind of peek through the gray Michigan winter clouds. The winter aconite was just starting to bloom. And she got this sense, she got this epiphany, if you will, of everything's going to be okay. I will be successful. I will carry on. And for her, that seminal moment in her life, linked to the botanical garden, was so important to her that she wanted to give back to the garden. And she told us the story. And you know, I'm almost getting teary-eyed thinking about it, but you know, it's just a wonderful, what a wonderful experience. This is one of the things gardens are about. This is one of the things that you're about with what you do. Because we bring inspiration to people. We make that people-plant connection. And I can't think of a better way of that people-plant connection being made than that late winter, early spring day on the campus of Michigan State Garden, Michigan State University in the Beale Botanical Garden for a student questioning her future and her place in the world. We are inspirations. We need to continue being inspirational to people, and that's wonderful. So anyway, the endowment is a wonderful thing that I continue to help to develop. We try to continue to meet the demands of diverse campus community, and our main role, again, what's our main objective is to facilitate and conduct collections-based research, teaching, and outreach. And so here's our 100th anniversary banner that Peter Carrington, one of my assistant curator, who will be taking you on tour tomorrow, has put together. And you know, here's a shade arbor that we had put in. This is another donor gift that we've put in. This came in the mid-1990s. Here's that Katsura tree that we talked about. So that's the Katsura tree right in the heart of the Beale Botanical Garden. What is the mission of a public garden? Again, education, research, conservation, public and professional service, arts, recreation, and contemplation. Okay, so we serve all of these things. We are a botanical garden because we have collections that are documented, as opposed to being a display garden. We actually curate the collections, a curated collection. But we serve all of these things. And I feel that if we do these well, these are value added. And the fact that we serve the MSU community of researchers, students, and faculty, and we have an organized, clean, attractive collection and garden, the public comes here and they want to learn and they want to know more about plants. And again, we facilitate that people-plant connection both indirectly through interpretive labels and beautiful displays, and as well through active teaching and active tours and active programs. One of the things that we do very actively is every year we produce an index seminum. This is our international seed catalog that we publish every year. We collect seeds from around the garden and around Michigan and actually from around the United States. When I travel and do research, I conduct research in Arizona. And so I collect a lot of seeds there. And we offer them up to 450 sister botanical institutions around the world. And we order seeds from those institutions as well to facilitate the collections and develop and continue to grow the collections at the Beale Botanical Garden. This kind of a map showing some of the counties that we've collected in that for seed that would be offered in this particular catalog. So again, a very important program that we're involved with that sponsors and supports teaching and research around the world. We're definitely linked. I developed a listserv through APGA for plant collections. It was the first APGA listserv was put into effect back in the mid-1990s. APGA, the American Public Gardens Association, now has many listservs for their various professional groups. The Garden Arboretum has an arts connection. Of course, there's been more campus art being put on campus. Jeff Kekos, my director in campus planning and administration, is heavily involved with that. But we had a wonderful opportunity back several years ago when Ellen Swillich, an award-winning composer, was hired by a donor who wanted to have a symphony composed that would commemorate and highlight the beauty of the MSU campus and the campus gardens. And so here I am talking to, you know, again, a much younger version of me, talking to Alan down in the garden. This is a Polonia tree. It comes up from a sprout, so it gets these big elephant ear-like leaves when it comes up like that. Normally, the leaves are not very big when the tree hasn't been cut back and has a sucker sprout, a water sprout like this. But she was impressed with that. And one of the things that I talked to her about were the living fossils, the ginkgo tree, the metasequoia. And one of the movements that she has are the living fossils in her symphony. We worked with the MSU Museum. We had a Fascination with Fibers exhibit, and we actually had sheep and llama down in the garden. We had people with looms down in the garden. We talked about natural dyes, the natural dye plant section, and again, making that people-plant arts connection. Botanica was an exhibit that the Art Museum had put on as well, and we were involved with the Botanica exhibit, where the artist was using plant material for his art form. So again, the garden is beautiful all times of the year. I'll show you a little bit of fall color here, just in this shot. We do have a docent program. Here's one of our docents talking to some visitors in the garden. The volunteer program, we'd be nowhere without volunteers. And this is a program that was established after I arrived in 1993. Elaine Chittenden, our collections manager, was the person that helped put that program together. By the way, unfortunately, with budget cuts, we've lost the collections manager position. Elaine Chittenden is now working up at Smith College in Massachusetts. But within the last few years, I've been able to hire Peter Carrington, and we have Peter Carrington 75% time to try to help with the duties in the garden. But Marlene Wesselman, that's our volunteer Marlene. The Marlene Wesselman Volunteer Award is named for her. She's got the most hours of anybody. She also volunteers for the horticultural demonstration gardens, the children's garden, and so forth. But our volunteers do three major things. We have a labor group that helps us do some labor in the garden. We have a docent group that take tours, school tours and interest groups tours of the garden. And then we also have what we call an ambassador program. We don't have a building per se. We don't have a visitor center like a lot of gardens do. So the docents, the ambassadors will set up a table, card table down in the garden, and they give a presence to the garden on weekends, especially on football weekends, so that if people have a question or they want some more interest in the garden or an impromptu tour of the garden, we offer that again, that people connection to the plants to make the people connect to the plants in the collection. Again, the garden has always been kind of viewed as a romantic place. Again, making that connection, as I mentioned before, many people have gotten engaged, went on their first date, and actually gotten married down in the garden. This is a wonderful old postcard that I think really expresses it very well. Again, this is Botanic Garden and Michigan Agricultural College in Lansing, a colorized card. In 2001, the garden was voted the most romantic place in the Lansing's People's Choice Award. So again, and I think we've gotten that since then, but how could you not agree with that? But again, we do many things in the garden. There's our verbascum flower. We have that in the garden. These are the kind of interpretive labels that we have that kind of make that connection so that people can learn just passively from walking through the garden. If all you want to know is what the name of the plant is, well, there's the name of the plant. You can walk on. If you want to know what the scientific name, that we have that, what its relationship is, where is it found. But then we can actually tell you a little bit of the story. And so this is from the systematic collection. And so the label is more systematically based, from a plant perspective. In the economic collection, we will be talking about what the economic uses of that plant. Is it used for dye? Is it used for medicine? Is it where does it fit within the scheme of what we used our plants for? And of course, this is the 21st century. Social media becomes very important. We've established a Facebook page last year. We've only got 191 likes so far, so we're hoping to get up there. Hidden Lake Gardens webpage. Hidden Lake Gardens, our sister garden down in Tipton. I don't think you're going to get a chance to go down and see Hidden Lake. That's a wonderful garden that we have down. It's about an hour and 15-minute drive to the southeast of us near Brooklyn, Michigan. They have, like, over 2,000 likes. So, but I was interim curator. I'm a director of Hidden Lake as well. So, but anyway. One of the things that's kind of interesting about Facebook, if those of you affiliated with it know, you can get interesting demographic data. And we have been trying to reach more of our younger demographic. People who are a little bit older tend to appreciate and like gardens. But we need to get young people excited about plants. We need to get young people excited about gardens. And so that's, by using Facebook, I'm really glad that we're able to begin to maybe reach out and get some people interested and keep putting posts up about activities. And so if we have a picture of me here before, I'll put a picture of, my talk up there on Facebook this afternoon, if I get a copy of that. So somebody taking a picture earlier. But again, also, where's our reach? Clearly, we're in the East Lansing area where we get a lot of people. But, you go down here, Iran, Mexico, and so forth. You look at the countries, Korea, Canada, Peru, Nigeria, Sudan. The different languages of people utilizing it. So you get some pretty interesting data off of Facebook. I didn't want to have my own personal Facebook page because I'm still like my privacy, but I had to have one in order to put this up. So now everybody wants to be my friend. It's like, who are you? I want to be your friend. So, but then you kind of find all kinds of interesting people from your past, and hopefully most of them you want to find, want to be found by. So it's an interesting experience if you haven't played with Facebook, but I try to put a minimal amount of information about myself out there. We got a little bit of time, I think. Just one of the things I'll talk a little bit about the campuses, our campus trees as well. This is Beaumont Tower. Here's one of the trees, this 1865 Norway spruce that was planted. This used to be the site of College Hall, our first building at Michigan State. Professor Beal, of course, growing up in the state, saw much of the deforestation that took place. Michigan helped to rebuild Chicago after the Great Chicago Fire. But he kind of realized that our forests were being decimated. And this is pictures that Professor Beal actually took in 1888, May 23rd, up at the Grayling Experiment Station. Professor Beal actually conducted a survey of the northern part of the Lower Peninsula across what we call the Jack Pine Plain. And he started out on the Lake Huron side and went to the Lake Michigan side. And Liberty Hyde Bailey actually traveled with them. And there was actually a reporter from the Detroit News that traveled with them. And they didn't have tweets back then, but, that was the version of tweets and being in a newspaper, would file reports from the field that were published in the Detroit News. And so if you get, the archives of Detroit News, you can actually follow this story of what they were doing. Because they were trying to find out, what do you do agriculturally? What can you grow? Being an agricultural college and having this important experiment station role, what can we do to help farmers who are buying this cut-over land and trying to grow plants on 300-foot deep glacial sand? Well, there wasn't a whole lot you could do up there, and that's why Michigan has the largest land holding of state-owned forest land, because so many people who had bought land, immigrants that came into the state, couldn't make a living off the land. And so it was reverted back to forests, which was actually a vision Professor Beal had back in 1888. And so he planted trees up at Grayling, was one of the, probably the earliest tree planting experiment in the country. A lot of people think of Yale University's forestry school. They think of Biltmore Estates and the Biltmore role in forestry and reforestation. Those things all happened after Professor Beal started this experiment up in Grayling, in which he had three treatments. He had a treatment where he weeded the trees and kept them free of weeds. He had another one where he just kind of spring harrowed it and planted trees. And then he had a control site where he didn't do anything to prepare the site and just planted trees. And, that's kind of what the site looked like before. That's what the site looked like 100 years late, over 100 years later. I had a graduate student who actually finished his master's degree, went up there and actually did an analysis of what Professor Beal's results were after, you know, after 110 years of the experiment being conducted. And so we did a survey to inventory what survived, because he was planting native and non-native species. He wondered how to grow trees. We didn't know how to grow trees in this country back in 1888. And if we want to reforest cut over lands rather than just allowing them go fallow or letting nature take over or letting farmers grow it, how do we do that? We just didn't know. And so this became a major experiment. He also has experimental plantations up in Oscoda and in Baldwin and in Harrison, Michigan. So all across that northern tier of states, he had these experimental stations that he had established where he did tree experimental plantings. And I got to investigate those, published a paper actually on that in the Michigan Botanist back in, I think it was 1999. But again, if we look on campus, his involvement in trees was also very important. Deer Park was referred to now because in subsequent years after Professor Beal started this as the Arboretum, a horticulture professor decided we needed to have deer and elk on campus. And so, yeah, thank you. Imagine Professor Beal going, ah! Okay. So they took the southern half of Professor Beal's Arboretum and turned it into a deer park, fenced it off. And, you know, I got pictures from the archive. You see the deer digging around and, you know, buck rubbing. It's like, ah. But anyway, to make a long story short, as Professor Beal was seeing all this going on, he was interested in planting trees, and that was one of his passions. He also actually wrote that, you know, of the things that he's been involved with at Michigan State, probably the most rewarding was the planting of trees. Talk as you please, only plant trees, or let them grow where nature sows the seed is one of his, you know, one of my favorite sayings that he had published. But Deer Park started out as a experimental forest arboretum tree planting. The Beal Arboretum is a more proper name that I like to call it. And in the fall of 1873, he had collected acorns off of several mature swamp white oaks that are actually still growing around Mayo Hall up here. Mayo Hall was built in the 1930s, and so we have a very long history of preserving trees in close proximity to construction on this campus, which carries on today. And so basically, he collected acorns from these trees and planted them in two rows right here on the west side of the Beal Arboretum. And in the mid-1990s, we had a new president, President McPherson, and he wanted to build a new residential college on campus, like we have Lyman Briggs College and some other honors college, the Honors College and so forth. And he needed room for an administration building. He said, well, that's just a vacant piece of land. Let's put a building there. And so Tom Keeler, who was then director of campus park and planning, told me about this and said, well, this is where Beal started his arboretum. Well, I was new on campus. I was still learning the law and history of the university and Professor Beal's contributions and everybody else since on the campus. So I went dutifully to archives and actually found a description that had been typed up by a horticulture professor of what was planted and when by Professor Beal. Unfortunately, Professor Beal's original notebooks had all burned in a garage fire. But I was actually able to reconstruct and determine what trees were planted when and how many trees still survived in this area. Father's Day, 6 o'clock in the evening, I'm out and working in my garage. My wife comes out holding the phone in the hand and says, Frank, it's the president. Bill? No, Pete. Oh, Bill Clinton's been there. I made it to the top. No, anyway. So he's like, you know, I talked to President McPherson. He says, you know, could you have time this evening? Can you come, you know, to campus and talk to me about your trees? My trees? Okay. And so I met him at Cole's house, the president's house, which is right here. And that's actually Professor Beal's residence for a while when he lived here on campus. And we walked up to the plot, he and his wife, and we talked about, you know, his vision for developing as a developer to build a building there. And I told him about the historic importance of these trees that were planted by Professor Beal. And those trees are still there, and the building was never built. And actually, President McPherson, I think, and his wife realized the value of trees on campus, and subsequently he made several significant contributions to the Campus Beautification Fund for planting more trees on campus. So again, helping make that people-plant connection. How do we make people appreciate? You know, I always like to tell people, I don't need to tell you this, but when I talk to a general audience, if we got rid of all the plants on this planet, we've got Mars. I mean, if it wasn't for plant life, we wouldn't be here. We rely on it for oxygen, for food, for clothing, for medicine, for so many things that we depend on plant life for. You remove plant life, You know, you see these commercials, you know, the chemical industry, you know, better living through chemistry and all this stuff. Well, you know, yeah. You could take away all of our oil products and we'd probably still make it okay. You know, you take away the plants, not so much. But again, Professor Beale was heavily involved with that. Of course, he was involved with the Beale Botanical Garden and also the Sanford Woodlot and Baker Woodlot. And he planted the Beale Pinetum as another forestry experiment starting in 1896. And back these days, he planted trees on four-foot centers. Well, they got to be pretty tight on four-foot centers. When he got to the Beale Pinetum a good 20 years later, 15 years later, he was planting them on 10-foot by 12-foot centers. And the Beale Pinetum is still here, and we actually have a paper that's accepted for publication in the Tree Ring Journal that we're finishing up. My colleague and I, we had a student's project to do a dendrochronology study where we cored the trees in here and actually showed how these trees are responding to climate over the past 100 years since they've been planted. So it's kind of a fun study. Baker Woodlot and Sanford Woodlot are major natural areas used by students for teaching and research as well as for recreation, just to get out there and enjoy the wildflowers. These areas were actually utilized for wood resources. People would harvest the trees for heating the campus buildings. Since then, we've put them under natural area protection. And we also have Red Cedar Woodlot over here. We have several other woodlots, total of 27 natural areas on campus that serve as a resource for teaching and research for our students, and as well as for limited recreation. We try to prevent too much recreation because we don't want to have trampling and destroying the native plants in there. It's more about plant conservation. Again, you've seen that shot of the arbor and the Beale. Here's the pond down in the garden, as you'll see it. That's probably about how it looks today. Our red buds have just begun to bloom this last day or two with the nice warm weather. We have wonderful natural beauty here on campus. We have a river that runs through it, the Red Cedar River. Here's one of those swamp white oaks that I talked about that was preserved when they built this building. This swamp white oak is at least 200 years old, if not more, because this tree was old enough to be producing acorns in the fall of 1873, because these are the trees, there's one back here too, that Professor Beale collected those acorns that he planted in the Beale Arboretum, the very first trees that he planted. And again, some of our old historic trees, here's that ginkgo biloba I was talking about, that was a gift from Macer Gray, Professor Gray up at Harvard. Here's one of the abies that we have down in the Beale Garden that was from planted in 1875. This taxodium tree was also planted fairly early on, but I haven't found any documentation for it, unfortunately. It's right next to the ginkgo tree. So, but again, these are all from about the time of George Thurber's tenure here on campus, 1860-1863. Another tradition is our memorial trees. Our oldest memorial tree is this wonderful white pine up by Cole's house. This is Cole's house back here. That's where Professor Beale lived. President Abbott was living here at the time when his daughter was born, and when his daughter was born, he planted this tree in honor of his daughter's birth. And then 20 years later, she got married underneath the tree. So again, wonderful traditions we have here for our plant collections and our tree collections here at Michigan State. And again, the garden we talked about was founded in 1873, and started the Arboretum, as I said, in 1874. This is the Arboretum. So here's Wells Hall. I mean, this is Mayo Hall. Here's another one of those big old swamp white oaks that's over 200 years old. Here are the trees that Professor Beale planted, all of these trees in here. He planted this tree, the Fraxinus Pennsylvanica, in 1878. Unfortunately, it was struck by lightning, and then we got emerald ash borer. So that tree doesn't exist anymore. But we collect seeds from our historic trees, and we have what we call Heritage Tree Program. And so trees that we have that we know a provenance from, we know some historical connection to them, even some of just the older trees, like these old trees that have been predate the campus, we collect seeds from them in the fall, we have a nursery, we grow them up, and we want to replant them on campus. But we're also going to be making them available as a fundraiser. So we're in the process of starting to put that together. So if some MSU alumni or staff say, I'd love to have one of those trees. Well, you know, for donation to planting more trees on campus, we can do that. But again, the Arboretum's mission is tradition of serving education, outreach, and research. Very important. By the way, that's the building I was talking about. That's Eustace Hall. That's the hall, if you get a chance to go out there and look at it. This is a historic row. That's the horticulture building. This is the old botany building where Professor Beal would have had his office. Forestry and entomology, there's Ag Hall. So it's just right around the circle as you walk up in this general area. So, and this is this my quote that I was trying to give you before. So I think this raising of forest trees is a promising field to demand our attention when these different kinds of trees are well started. Some people of our state will want to learn how each variety thrives and what they may plant. So this is Professor Beal from 1876. And of the various things attempted since my connection with the Agricultural College, few have given greater satisfaction, considering the outlay of time and money, than the selection and growing of trees. Professor Beal, 1886. So we have a wonderful tradition in our trees. So Ernst Bogue was the first professor of forestry. He started the Bogue Arboretum, which is just to our southeast. Find those there. The trees are planted again in rows. Here we can see some Larix occidentalis. The forestry cabin, there used to be a forestry cabin up here before they built the International Center. But when they built the International Center, a lot of this area had been cut down, but we still have some remnants. But here's we got lots of squirrels on campus. If you go out on campus, you have a paper sack, you're going to find yourself surrounded by squirrels. You know, it's almost like an Alfred Hitchcock movie. Ah! Doot, doot, doot. Anyway. Glenn T. Phillips was our consulting architect that wanted to make sure we kept this campus park concept, the concept of the campus park, the campus landscape as a park-like feature with all these beautiful trees. And we have an architecture department, we have landscape architects that actually we work with that are part of the MSU Department of Engineering and Architectural Services. So we actually have our own in-house architects that work on design work here at Michigan State. And again, just kind of keeping the unusual, this is one of the original metasequoias. We received this in 1954 from the Arnold Arboretum. It's still doing well. We just installed lightning protection up in the top of it. It's over 100 foot tall. So Milt Barron also is responsible for introducing many new plant species to the market. So Cerberus acuparia, Cardinal Royal, is Westminster Globe English Oak, Skymaster English Oak, and Sugar Time, probably one of his best known Malus introductions, is a Milt Barron and American Spirit. And again, I said Milt Barron is celebrating his 100th birthday this month. James Hanover, Professor of Forestry, gave us Spartan Spruce. It's a cross between white spruce and blue spruce. We have two trees up by Cole's house. He also created, for the bicentennial, the American spruce, which is red, white, and blue spruce hybrid. So but we have one of these that we've planted now in memory of Professor Hanover, who passed away before I arrived here on campus in the early 1990s. But we planted one up over by the Natural Resources Building, where forestry is located, in his honor. So it's part of our memorial tree planting. So again, maintaining diversity of collections for research, teaching, and outreach, aesthetics and campus beauty is all the mission of what we do with our plant collections on campus. And standing literally on the shoulders of people like William James Beal, Professor Thurber, Professor Barron, and many others. So campus beautification, as I mentioned before, we're trying to plant more trees on South Campus where there's a lot of compaction. And the future, we're adding new collections, always adding new things to collection. We actually have a sequoia dendron. You'll see this tree much taller than it is now, doing quite well. This tree actually, fun little story, when I was a high school student, I did science fair projects. I bought lots of seeds from trees because I love trees, from F.W. Schumacher in Sandwich, Massachusetts. I bought an ounce of sequoia dendron seeds. Well, that's the smallest quantity you could buy. Well, these are little wafer-thin seeds. So you get lots and lots of seeds. So I did my science fair project. I actually ended up going to the International Science and Engineering Fair in San Diego that year and received fourth place in botany as a high school student. It was a wonderful experience for me, and I really enjoyed it. But I kept these seeds. I can't throw seeds away. So I went off to college, went off to graduate school, went off to Arizona. My mom ships the beer. They're clogging up the refrigerator. Take them. So now they're clogging my refrigerator in Arizona. I moved to Buffalo, New York. They're in my refrigerator. My wife's like, what are we going to do with these seeds? I don't know. Okay. So I moved to Michigan, and I tell you, hey, we got a seed storage facility. I'll take them out to the nursery and put them in the seed storage facility. Yay, they're out of my refrigerator. Okay. So Tim Bolin, who was our nursery manager at the time, went ahead and asked me, so what do you want to do with these? So I don't know. I don't even know if they're viable anymore. Well, let's find out. Sure. So we planted them, and lo and behold, after 20 years in the storage, I had my own seed experiment. They germinated, and so there they are on campus. And Mespelis canadensis was planted in 1997. That's this little plant over here in the Rosaceae. You talk about new species. You know, oh, we know everything there is to know about the world, you know, the plant world. Yeah. This is a plant that was discovered, I think it was in the 1980s in Arkansas. New species. In Arkansas, you don't have to go to the tropical rainforest of Borneo to find new species. They could actually be right under your nose. Just that you have to be a keen observer of the world. You have to keep squinting. So, and that's about it. Thank you. Thank you for the extra time, because I was able to go through that last part there. I would have just stopped it right before the traditions through the trees part of it. So I'm glad I actually left. I was gonna delete those, so I was like, I'm glad I didn't. Yes?
I wish it had been the first thing we saw when we came here, because we've been walking back and forth between those trees.
So now you actually look at them and say, hey, I know that tree.
Yeah. Like,
well, now you can do that still. So you're still here for a few more days. So. Yes?
I've noticed a lot of beautiful crab apples.
Yes.
Is there a plan to those?
When Milt Barron and George Parmley were here, they were very interested in a lot of ornamental plants. And one of the things they were very interested in were crab apples. And so we had put together an extensive crab apple collection during their time. Again, unfortunately, you know, some things are on cards, some things were handwritten. I'm trying to put the whole thing together. Father Phyla wrote a book on crab apples, sort of the seminal book on crab apples, and he references several national collections of crab apples and which crab apples are which selection. Arnold Arboretum is referenced in there. I think the Morton Arboretum is referenced in there. We're referenced in there, Michigan State University. When I came here, again, this is the problem with not having good continuity in programs, and I'm very conscious and very aware of this. There was that period of time when Professor Donnelly had left to go to the Morton. And before I came here, and we had a new campus arborist and other people, and I got here, and the attitude was, it's a crab apple. We have lots of crab apples. We can cut it down. I started looking at it from a collections perspective. It says, you know, that's the only variety of that crab apple left that we know of in the world. And so I put together a program to begin to conserve what crab apples we have left. We've lost a lot of them in the ensuing, you know, years, because, you know, some people that in the maintenance end of things just didn't realize that this is why it's a collection. This is why you need a curator, okay, rather than just looking at it as a landscape. Landscapes are beautiful. I always like to say the Beale Garden and MSU's campus, it's more than just a pretty place. They're not just another pretty face, not just another pretty face, a place. You know, it's a collection. I've been going through and on our onesie twosie crab apples and working with a grafter, a propagator, and we've been propagating these and putting them back out of the nursery and bringing them back to campus, because some of these are one of a kind crab apples. I've checked with other collections, and, you know, people just don't have them anymore. Some of them are rare. We propagate those as well. If it's got good features, and if it's something that's being devastated by apple scab, you know, or fire blight, you know, we're not gonna keep in the collection. But if it's something that's just rare because it's rare, and then what happens is that people pick up that reference book, the crab apple, Phyla's crab apple book, and I get emails, I get phone calls. According to Father Phyla, you have such a, can, you know, do you still have that? Can we get signwood? Because I'm looking at the genetics of the hybridization of this group of crab apples. So now with molecular biology, or you get some grower, that particular strain is I want to use in a breeding program, and nobody else has it. I've checked with the Arnold. I've checked with the Morton. You're the only, do you have it? Yes, we've got one. Oh, please, can you send me signwood? So again, this is a valuable component of being a curated collection. And yes, we do have an extensive collection of crab apples, and we're hoping to continue bolstering that collection and developing it further with new crab apple varieties, as well as the old ones that we preserve. Yeah.
What did you find for your study of
trees
in the pineal?
Excuse me?
Your trees in the pineal, what did you find?
What we were interested to find out was what are they responding to? Because he planted these trees in a sandy area, but it was right on in the floodway and on a little bit of a flood terrace. And in dendrochronology, we normally talk about trees that are stressed or in a limited environment. You wouldn't think that trees growing right next to a river would be stressed. And lo and behold, we actually got a good climatic response to those trees. And actually, some of those trees have what we refer to as missing rings. In other words, the tree was so stressed in certain years, 1988 was a particularly drought year here in Michigan, that that ring was not formed completely around the entire circumference of the tree. And so when you do your tree ring dating, when you actually match up your patterns, that ring shows up as an absent or locally absent missing ring in the chronology. Is that stressful for the tree? And we found out that, we kind of thought the trees growing up on the higher site had more sensitivity than the trees growing in a lower site, because of a lower site that are closer to the water. But yet both trees responded to climate in a way that we hadn't really thought they would, because they were so close to water. And one of the things that they were responding to, we found out, was winter flooding. They actually responded negatively to winter flooding, and we think what's happening is that during the wintertime, when you get a severe flood, that it causes this root zone to go anoxic, and so that what does is it kills a lot of the fine roots and maybe kills some of the mycorrhizal associations. And so the following spring, the tree has to put energy into restoring the fine roots, and so it doesn't have as much energy to put into the annual growth ring, so that growth ring is a little bit narrower for that subsequent year after a severe winter flood. So this is kind of some of the things that we found out. But again, utilizing the collections and the research, very important. One of the things that we have is I'm looking at creating an undergraduate research summer research scholarship. The dean's office has a $3,000 scholarship for undergraduates to support them during the summertime to do undergraduate research. And some of my students have benefited from that, but we're going to take some of our endowment money and create that to encourage professors here on campus to utilize specifically plants in the collections to try to strengthen that academic connection. I'm here affiliated with the university. Okay, so if you have a garden at your university, a botanical garden at your university, if you don't have a strong plant sciences program, or even if you have a strong plant science program, you'll find that a lot of the curatorial staff, the director, will say, why can't we get faculty more interested in utilizing the collections? I have a little bit of that problem, fortunately not too much. I've been very aggressive about maintaining that academic connection to the collections. We have a lot of professors who do make use of our collections. But by making a small fellowship, a small investment of money available to those students, that may encourage faculty to then actually look at a creative way to utilize the collections in their research. I guess my time is up. I have expired.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.